Hello from the Talking Information Center, and welcome to The Poet's Voice, a program supported by America's Hometown Laureates, Inc., and dedicated to the place of poetry in our lives and communities. Today, poet Jean Creeling, that's me, will interview poet Brian Mosier. We both live in southeastern Massachusetts, and our poems have appeared in numerous print and online journals. Between us, we've published 7 collections of poetry, with more in progress, and Brian has also published short stories. Today, I'll be talking with Brian about his insights and opinions concerning poetry, and we'll hear him read some of his poems. Welcome, Brian.
Well, thank you, Jean. Happy to be here.
To get us started with some conversation and some poetry, please tell us about one of your favorite things to write about and read us one of your poems on that topic.
Sure. I think this is something that really changes over time, or it has for me. As a younger person, I had a whole different outlook on things that I wanted to write about. I went through a phase, I think most young men do, of feeling that they're smarter than everyone else.
Mm-hmm.
And so wanting to sort of share my wisdom, which is obviously fairly foolish. And then when there's a new love, there are a lot of love poems, etc. But I think lately I've noticed, and I think this is a factor of getting to be a little bit older, that I'm writing a lot of nostalgic poems, poems about my childhood or my early family history, so to speak. So as an example of that, this is a poem called Coloring, which is comes from an absolutely 100% true story. Coloring. My parents bought a used 65 Dodge Dart, white inside and out, Dad's pride and joy, and I, just a boy, left unbuckled, untethered, saw the back of the front seat as a blank canvas, which I covered in patternless Crayola tones, an abstract masterpiece faded to black and white in memory. Consequences swift, but not corporal. Lesson learned. Elbow grease cleans wax off vinyl. Flash forward to a different world where artificial light explodes from all my screens, distracting and assaulting me with hues no naive Technicolor musical could have foretold, while a gloomy future looms uncertainly in shades of gray and sepia brown, and my clicking knees and knuckles count the seconds, punishment for the simple crime of having survived. And now, having lived through 62 gray winters, green springs, white hot summers, and firework bright autumns, all scrambled together in a shapeless swirl of errors and triumphs, revelations and deceits, injuries sustained and inflicted, I still paint outside the lines, with words instead of crayons, and still usually clean up my own mess.
That's wonderful. The childhood story is so vivid, and then that theme of color connects it to the person you are today.
Right. That was the objective. Initially, it was just to capture that childhood moment, and it felt like it needed to carry forward.
So. Funny how a poem starts to tell you it needs to go on.
That's exactly right.
Thinking about the power and place of poetry, how did it enter your life? Who introduced you to poetry, and when did you start writing it?
So I think I became aware of words and sort of the power of words, and also the ways in which you can be playful and manipulate words at a really early age, with my parents reading Dr. Seuss books to me, right?
Right.
Just the playfulness of that. I had an uncle, my mother's brother, my Uncle Bill, who was a master of the spoonerism, the changing of the first syllable or the first sound of one word with the first sound of the next word. And he would tell us these amazing versions of nursery rhymes and fairy tales. He told us about Rindicella, who sloshed her dripper on the way to the fancy fall, and the Prancing Hints found the dripper that she had sloshed. And he did the same with the three little pigs, became the pea little thrigs. And so again, this, in addition to probably giving me my really corny sense of humor that I have, mm-hmm. also helped me realize that you can manipulate words, you can use right. words. I became aware as a adolescent and a teenager, became aware of the music of the 1960s. This was in the 1970s. So very influenced by the work of Bob Dylan and the Beatles.
Right.
And I thought that that felt more like something I could do as opposed to the poetry we were learning about in high school,
mm-hmm.
Which was very much the, you know, the romantics and the people that just seem superhuman mm-hmm. beyond what...
Another world.
Another world, right. And difficult to relate to, I think, as mm-hmm. as a teenager. But then in college, freshman English class, in college, we had an assignment, write a poem. And I got some very good feedback from the teacher about it, although in retrospect, it was something I'm sure I stole almost 100% from Neil Young. but still, that encouragement goes a long way.
Absolutely.
And put in my mind the idea that potentially I could write poetry or you know, what have you.
Who are your favorite poets, and why, and how have they influenced you?
Mm-hmm. Again, this is something that changes over time. I think the first poet that I loved in that way was Walt Whitman. Just the freedom,
mm-hmm.
the joy you could hear right on the page, the super long lines, the language is clearly poetic, but it's also accessible in a way that a lot of those other people we learned about in high school wasn't, at least
mm-hmm.
for me.
Mm-hmm.
And again, just that freedom, right? That he didn't feel himself tied down to following the rules,
right?
In a similar way, but also very, very different way, E.E. Cummings was an early influence on me. His work was also very, I think, rebellious in a way, and innovative, right? He created his own way of writing, but in a way unlike Whitman, that was very, very concise and controlled and intellectual, I think, in a way that appealed to me, even though it's not something I can do.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of other poets over the years, Charles Bukowski, again, for that sort of freedom and rebelliousness. I love Philip Larkin, Frank O'Hara.
Mm-hmm.
And then also people that I've met over the last few years, you know, yourself, Miriam O'Neill.
Yes.
And people that I've created friendships with and relationships with. I have a group. We meet once a month and give feedback. Mark Walsh, John Holderson, Elizabeth Birch, all local poets. And that kind of thing is at least as influential on my work
right.
as any of the masters
yeah.
that I've read.
It's so helpful to workshop with other poets.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I share with friends or siblings, and the feedback is, oh, I love that, which mm-hmm. is nice.
Yeah.
But it's not helpful.
Right.
I know, I think we all know we could always be better.
Yeah.
And so that's what's so valuable about that kind of feedback.
Absolutely. I think your work is mostly free verse, though. I know you've written a couple of villanelles and some song lyrics. In any case, how do you go about shaping a poem? What gives it its form, its shape?
Mm-hmm. For me, form and shape come second, and I think sort of grow organically, more or less, out of what I want to say. The idea is first almost all the time. Occasionally it'll start with a phrase.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'll hear someone say something, or a phrase will just occur to me. Or I'll mishear something in a song lyric that becomes something else. But shape and form in that sense for me doesn't happen until well into the editing phase. I want to make sure I'm saying what I want to say first with language that has some musicality to it. I love rhyme and I love alliteration, but I don't typically let myself be, or I wouldn't say let myself, I don't typically enjoy being tied down to the formality mm-hmm. of the mm-hmm. sonnet or the villanelle or what have you.
Mm-hmm.
The poem takes its own shape or it mm-hmm. leads you to its own shape, I think.
Mm-hmm.
I think Mark Twain said writing is easy. All you have to do is cross out the wrong words.
Right.
I'll put a lot of words down on the page and then sort of chip away and whittle away till both the meaning that I want is there and the shape sort of emerges.
Right, right. Is that true, though, of your villanelles, which have a lot of structure, a lot of required rhyme and repetition?
Mm-hmm. So the couple of times that I've written villanelles, one time was really just as an exercise for myself. Can I do this?
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And another time was as part of an ekphrastic project that I've been working on, so poetry in response to art. And the particular piece of art is very geometrical, very straight lines, and I don't think there's a curve anywhere mm-hmm. in it. And so it just seemed to me that it needed something more formal along that same
mm-hmm.
vein. And it's interesting. It can be rewarding, right, because there are those restrictions and rules. And when you achieve that, it feels like, right, you've carved something out that other people will recognize as poetry.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And so there's an accomplishment that goes along with that. But I don't really enjoy it to the same extent.
So I guess it's fair to say that in all of your poems, and this sounds kind of mystical, but I think it's true, the poem leads you to its own form.
Yeah.
It clearly helps you decide how it should look.
I think that's right. And I don't like to think about that too much. Like the old story about the centipede, when the ant asked him, how does he possibly keep all those legs coordinated? And he stopped to think about it and suddenly trips and falls.
Right.
I don't want to overanalyze
yeah.
why the way I do it seems to work.
Mm-hmm. Just have to keep doing it.
That's it.
So we both know that poems arrive from many different places, a memory, an image, a phrase. Would you please read us a poem of your own and tell us its origin story? And that can go in either order, poem first or story first.
Sure. So I get a lot of inspiration both for my poetry and my fiction from being in restaurants and bar rooms. You overhear things. I hear voices,
mm-hmm.
right? In this particular instance, I was in a Mexican restaurant in Plymouth, and I was noticing how many different tequila bottles there are, how many different brands of tequila there are. I just had no idea.
Nor do I.
Yeah. It's kind of fascinating. and some of the bottles are really beautiful.
Yeah.
But in particular, I noticed these two bottles that both had Frida Kahlo's face on the label. Which just seemed odd to me. I knew a little bit about Frida. I was aware of her, obviously, and had seen some of her artwork. But seeing her face on these tequila bottles just made me curious. I did a little bit of research, by which I mean probably about a half an hour on Wikipedia and one or two other websites dedicated to Frida's life and work. And I learned quite a bit about her that I didn't know, became aware of more of her artwork than I had seen before. And so the whole thing just seemed somewhat offensive to me, although I'm sure it's not my place to be offended on Frida's behalf. But in any event, that's turned into this poem, which is called Frida's Tequila, and it comes with this epigraph, rather. There have been two great accidents in my life. One was the trolley, and the other was Diego. Diego was by far the worst. Magdalena, Carmen, Frida, Kahlo y Calderon. Courageous Frida, icon to millions who know no more of you than your eyebrows on the t-shirts your face adorns. What is your name worth now? What value added by the pain you suffered through decades of disease and injury? The few small nips delivered by the hand of your passionate husband. We find you, wounded deer, desperate and afraid, lost in the forest without hope, force-fed against your will only to prolong a life of agony, a life dominated by Diego, who seemed to live inside your mind like a ghost, though still alive, while you, bedridden, painted until your final breath. You wished to be found inside our darkest everything. I wonder, did you wish to be found on the label of a tequila bottle? Magdalena Carmen, the spirit of Bizet's fiery gypsy gifted to you in that naming, along with the sexual appetite of your biblical eponym, how are we to square that burning ardor with the reduction of your public name to an ingredient in margaritas, in trendy taquerias? Today, when we finally recognize more than two genders, two orientations, your openness, honesty, self-expression, self-objectification echo heroically down the years, while your grandnieces hope the centuries of torture you suffered add stature to the brand they founded upon your face and name. Forgive them, Frida, as you forgave Diego, and leave it to us to judge those who trespass.
Very nice. I've learned more about Frida Kahlo. There's such a clear tone of indignation as you tell that story. And I love the title. Frida's Tequila immediately raises the questions that you address in that poem.
Thank you. Typically, the title is difficult for me, one of the biggest challenges. But in this case, it's what came first.
Oh, really?
And then the rest sort of happened. I like that it sounds, you know, it sounds good together. But also, as you said, it sort of gives a preview of the what's
right.
to come.
Right. The title itself is thought provoking, and titles can do a lot of important work in a poem.
Absolutely, that's something that I'm still learning, I think.
It is hard to come up with the right title sometimes.
Absolutely.
And that certainly is a unique stimulus for a poem, the label on a tequila bottle.
This is it. People ask that question all the time, right? The people that are in my life that aren't necessarily creative, that's usually one of the biggest questions that they'll ask. Where do you get your ideas? They're everywhere.
Yeah.
Right? All the time.
Yeah. And poets understand that. Yeah. So, the last several minutes of this program are all yours, Brian. I'm going to ask you to read a few more poems for us and say a few words about each, including letting us know if they are in one of your books.
Terrific. Thank you. I'm going to read a couple from my most recently published book, which came out in March of 2025. As I said earlier, I love alliteration, and the title of this book is A Muster of Melodious Musings. It was published by Metaphysical Fox Press and can be found on Amazon. This poem is called So Much Depends. So much depends on where you stand, which direction you face, how strong the wind, how fair the skies. So much is determined by timing, by when you begin and with whom, the season, the phase of the moon. So much rides on one roll of the dice, a spin of the wheel, on who marked the cards and who deals. Your future can change in an instant, redirected by something as small as the scent of her hair, the color of her eyes. The face you choose to hold in the diamond of your mind is the fulcrum upon which you balance yourself. So choose wisely, and never underestimate the importance of how well your hand fits inside another's. Now, one of the lines in that poem, the diamond of your mind is the fulcrum. I told you I have this group where we provide feedback to each other. And that was one line that one of the members of the group just totally did not like. He said, that does not belong. It doesn't make sense to me. Take it out. But I I defied his advice and left it in there. And the poem was published by Nix's Mate back in October of 24, Nix's Mate Journal. So I felt vindicated.
Good for you.
Yes.
It can be hard to take a suggestion, and it's also hard to reject a suggestion mm-hmm. when it comes from a source you trust.
Exactly. That's exactly right.
Yeah.
And I asked for the feedback, right?
That's
the whole intention. This is another one from the same book, and it's another example of an idea coming from maybe an unexpected source. I was just on a walk on an evening to an open mic venue in, near where I live, and just this incident happened. Incident is too dramatic, probably, but what I describe here happened mm-hmm. as I was on this walk, and it just made me think about things in a different way. And the poem is called No Threat. Verse 1, in which I walk across town after dinner at my favorite tavern toward an evening of fellowship with like-minded creators on a sunlit early evening in July, full of nothing but a sense of peaceful well-being. Verse 2, in which I enter the public walkway, stroll past the smallest park I've ever seen, only a few benches, a dog shit bag dispenser, and a trash barrel, and spy a young woman at the other end of the path walking toward me. Verse 3, in which she becomes aware of me, slightly changes course, moves to the far edge of the pathway, forces me to realize that, despite my sense of myself as unthreatening, she sees some darker potential. Verse 4, in which we each make every effort to avoid eye contact, me out of a desire to give no cause for concern, no reason for fear, she, I presume, to give me no excuse to speak to her, to intrude on her space, her peace, her safety. Verse 5, in which I would wish to draw some profound conclusion, but realize the women among us know all too well the truth here revealed, a truth the men among us could never understand, much less explain. As the father of a daughter, it struck me, right? She's someone's daughter just on a perfectly innocent walk and felt threatened because we were the only two human beings mm-hmm. around, and mm-hmm. she's a woman and I'm a man.
Right.
And for no other reason, right?
Yeah.
And it struck me that that's something that most women probably have felt many times mm-hmm. in their lives, and it disturbed me. I want to read a few now, if I can, from my book that's going to scheduled to be published later this month, January 23rd.
Yay.
Although the publisher told me they're running a little bit behind, so... but still, it shouldn't be long. The book is called Relict, R-E-L-I-C-T, and it's published by Finishing Line Press. And it's poems that began as growing out of my grief when my father passed away. But then there were also poems in the book about his childhood, our family life together again, and then the experience of his death and my grief and growing mm-hmm. beyond that. And this one is called The Final Decision. His doctor's call raised us from not quite sleep. Come now, if you want to say goodbye. Ever he had carried us on slender shoulders, taxi driver or batting practice pitcher, no matter how tired from a day at the factory. And now, as when we were children, tucking us in warm and clean before putting himself to bed, he had waited until we were safely out of sight before letting go of life. Mm. Within maybe 2 or 3 years, 3 or 4 years maybe, after my father's death, his youngest brother became ill and was in the same hospital that my father had been in when he died. Mm-hmm. The same wing of the hospital, and it just stirred things up, obviously.
Sure.
And so this is called Return to the Scene. Like images in a mirror, My uncle's death resembles my father's, as one oak tree does the next, as their faces did each other, as mine resembles them both. The same ward, same suite of rooms where I held my father's hand to comfort myself, now holds my uncle, his lifelong best friend, and almost twin, who reaches his hand to me. Beeping monitors, the hum of machinery, the compressing thump of ventilators, rubber-wheeled meal carts squeaking across linoleum, hushed voices, muffled moans. Compassionate nurses and emotionless doctors, the worried faces of loved ones repeated in room after room along a disorienting maze of identical hallways. Amid the acrid acid smell of urine-soaked sheets, of impotent antiseptic, of illness and decay, time collapses, disappears, folds back on itself or forward, and I do not know whose bedside I sit at, whose death I dread.
Very moving and very recognizable to anyone who's lost a loved one.
Thank you, yeah. Some of these things are universal.
Right.
I'll close with one more. This is not in any of my published books, although I hope it'll be in the manuscript of the next one. And it's sort of an alternate timeline. What would have happened if, mm-hmm. sort of a poem. And it's called The Pivot, or Streptococcus pneumoniae and me. If not for pneumonia and the lack of penicillin, my grandmother would not have died in 1941, leaving a husband bereaved and two children motherless. If not for his sudden widowerhood, my grandfather would not have relocated with his carrot-top daughter to the town where my father was growing up, 60 miles to the south. If not for meeting that redhead, my father might have married another, perhaps a nice Italian girl, and had a son who learned to love lasagna much younger than I did.
Wonderful.
Thank you.
Brian, thank you so much for sharing your work and for your own take on The Poet's Voice. And thanks to our audience for joining us. Listeners, if you'd like to follow our program, remember to check your TIC listings for future broadcasts of The Poet's Voice.